Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to session number 263, Tinkleman and Jones, Using Genealogy to Bridge My Jewish Mormon Angst. Sounds like a really fun topic. I'm excited. My name is Micah Nicolaisen. I'll be chairing the discussion, which basically means I'm supposed to make sure all this stuff is working. Otherwise, you shouldn't hear from me very much. Our primary speaker is Linda Jones Gibbs, who received her PhD in art history in 1999 and has been working in the New York City area as an independent scholar and art historian since 2001. She is currently assisting with the development of a new student gallery for the College of Fine Arts at the University of Utah and writing press releases and information brochures for contemporary artists primarily in New York City galleries. Once I am done, I'm going to turn the time over for Linda, and she will give her presentation for 35 to 40 minutes. Afterwards, we will hear a response from Nancy Ross, who is a spokesperson for ordained women and chairs the social media committee. She teaches art history at Dixie State University and received her PhD from the University of Cambridge in 2007. She is currently blogging the Book of Mormon chapter by chapter from a feminist and personal response perspective at Nickel on the Knackle at blogspot.com. All right, Linda, time is now yours. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm supposed to remind everybody to turn off their cell phones. That was my other job.
I don't get to Utah very much. I don't have any family to speak of here, but I have a lot of good friends. A lot of you who are here, thank you. But actually, it was family that brought me to New York this week, deceased family, because I'm spending the week down at the Hilton at the Jewish Genealogy Conference, and it was just a wonderful coincidence that Sunstone was happening at the same time, and I thought, I'm going to propose a paper that links why I'm coming to Salt Lake in the first place with what I'm going to talk to you about. The tale of someone's life begins before they are born. This is a statement written by Michael Wood in his biography of Shakespeare. About 20 years ago, while attending a Sunstone conference, a friend introduced me to Omar Cater, a former professor of political science at BYU. He was born in Provo of Muslim Palestinian parents and a convert to Mormonism. At the time, I was working as a curator at the Museum of Art at BYU, helping with the opening of its inaugural exhibitions. I spent the previous 5 years in New York and was perfectly happy to return home east when my job was done. But the museum administrators were entreating me to stay on, and the thought of continuing to help shape an institution, an art institution at one of my alma maters was enticing. Upon introducing me to Dr. Cater, my friend said, "Linda's trying to decide if she should remain in a position at BYU." Dr. Cater had one question: "Do you descend from Mormon pioneer ancestry?" And I thought that was really odd. But I said, "Well, I've got pioneer ancestors on my father's side, but my mother's Jewish." And he just said, "Don't do it." So I pondered that response many times over the years, and I didn't do it, by the way. And I contacted him a few weeks ago at his home in Virginia to probe him a little bit about that conversation. And he explained to me, he says that he as a Palestinian and I as a Jew would never be anything more than guests in the house of the church. And I'm not going to take the time to elaborate. If we have time and you're curious at the end, I'll elaborate. Near the end of our lengthy conversation, Omar told me something I think I already knew. "You have a Jewish mind," he said. "How can this be?" I pondered aloud, when I was not brought up with any Jewish education. Once again, he gave me a succinct answer: DNA. In Mormonism, there is a saying, when the prophet speaks, the debate is over. In Judaism, when anyone says anything, the debate begins. You know, two Jews, three opinions. Debate is sacred to Judaism. It is believed to be the way to truth. In traditional Jewish books of learning, the concepts of beginning and end do not exist. It's all about the middle, the dialogues, the exchange of ideas. Diverse opinions have purposefully been codified and preserved in Talmudic literature. This in contrast to Mormonism's tendency to obscure contradictions and controversy in its past and to discourage discourse. It is this Jewish approach to learning and understanding that I relish and which has repeatedly created conflict within my LDS church experience. My father, born in American Fork, was an inactive Mormon all his adult life. My mother, born in Brooklyn, a secular Jew, converted to Mormonism after their marriage, not to please him, but because she found comfort in the notion of an eternal family, which is rather vague in Judaism. She was above all else, very much a Jewish mother and a somewhat lapsed Mormon later in life. As a military brat, I had a peripatetic childhood spent in Japan, numerous other places in the country. And my first memory of church defiance happened when I was 10 years old, when I stood up in a Sunday school class in San Antonio, Texas, when the teacher, a male teacher, said something I found offensive about women in the priesthood. This is before feminism, I think, was even a word. And I confronted him and stormed out. I didn't set foot in Utah until I was 16 for a brief vacation. And 2 years later, I returned to attend BYU. And after completing my BA, I headed for the University of Utah, where I got my MA. And at the same time was offered a job working for the Church Historical Department in the New Arts and Sites Division, and later the Museum of Church History and Art. As a church employee, I repeatedly forgot that I was a guest in the house, and a female guest at that, and on numerous occasions was reprimanded for overstepping my bounds. I finally realized I needed to leave Utah to preserve my sanity. The geographic cultural fit wasn't right. So 27 years ago, I can't believe it's been that long, my husband and I moved to New York, the place of my birth, where I pursued a PhD in art history. And there I found my Jewish self coming and going on every street corner. Ah, Mecca. My feminist, intellectual, politically left-wing self felt perfectly at home. I could enjoy both my wonderfully diverse Mormon congregation and the world of bar mitzvahs and Passover with Jewish friends who became like family. I delighted in seeing my husband wear a yarmulke. I reconnected with Jewish relatives. I loved the fact that in New York, strangers on the street praised my bravery for having two children so close in age as I walked down the street pregnant, pushing a stroller. In Utah, they would have wondered why I only had two. Yes, this was the place for me. While living in New York, I experienced some interior conflict with the church. They were usually small things until Prop 22 in the year 2000, when the church pressured members in California to financially support legislation against gay marriage. No, not Prop 8. There was something...
The first one?
First, yes. I was visiting friends. I heard all about it, how they were pressured by their bishop. As a firm believer in the separation of church and state and unequivocally committed to civil rights, I was livid. A few years later, in 2004, in honor of the Manhattan Temple dedication, the church rented Radio City Music Hall, where the youth of the tri-state region put on this grand extravaganza in honoring New York City for President... Who was it? Jeez, Hinckley. And the other general authorities. My husband and I were chaperones at the event, and during the rehearsal, the day of the performance, my teenage son grabbed me and said, "Mom, you've got to see this." And he's like my partner in protest crime. I followed him downstairs, where I was shocked and offended to see a large sculpture that someone had draped with a bright blue blanket. The work of art, The Spirit of the Dance, by William Zorak, on display in the music hall since 1932 when it was created, depicts a monumental and somewhat stylized nude female dancer preparing to take a bow. So with the blue blanket, it looked like someone had tried to help her back on with her shawl. The work was deemed by the overseeing local church leaders as potentially offensive should President Hinckley need to go downstairs to use the bathroom. Well, the tendrils of Mormonism's puritanism and provinciality that had prevented BYU's museum from exhibiting several Rodin sculptures in 1997 had now come slithering across the country at breakneck speed to encroach on the safe art space I thought I had found in New York. Without forethought and in a flash, I found myself climbing up on the base of the statue where I began to untie the blanket. Security came running over, chatting anxiously on their walkie-talkies, and ultimately a man from the Connecticut State who was in charge appeared at my feet. "You can't do this," he yelled at me over the din of the young people that were gathered around the bathrooms. "Yes, I can," I yelled back down at him. "I'm doing this for every artist who's ever lived." Is this the way for a good Mormon woman, a descendant of obedient pioneers, to behave? I think not. Is this the way the descendant of both a Russian Trotskyite and an agitator and co-founder of the Moldavian Soviet Socialist Republic behave? Perhaps so. At any rate, the blanket remained off.
Bravo.
My career as an art historian has focused not only on formal analyses determining the aesthetic merits of a particular work of art, but on contextual analysis extracting layers of meaning from various contexts such as social and cultural history, political ideology, and theoretical perspectives such as feminism, psychobiography, in order to explain form. In recent years, as my interest in and passion for genealogy has grown, I've taken my research skills and analytical mindset and turned them upon myself. Don't want you guys to get too polluted visually there with that naked body. So I've taken my research skills and put them on myself. I enjoy American essayist Roger Rosenblatt's celebratory recognition of his own uniqueness. "I am the spitting image of myself," he wrote. How like myself I am. Yet it's obvious that we carry with us physical and psychological traits of those who have come before us. I'm fascinated by current scientific research on the somewhat controversial notion of genetic memory. It's called transgenerational epigenetic inheritance, where you can actually inherit or the genes, depending on what happened to your forebears, can actually alter the gene if it's usually trauma. And one article actually mentioned Russian Jews and the shtetls, Chinese and the Cultural Revolution, etc. I am the granddaughter of Eastern European Jewish immigrants and the great-granddaughter of Mormon pioneers. I have felt at times as if the strands of my DNA were in the process of co-strangulation. At no time did this molecular tussle manifest itself more as vehemently as it did in 2008, with the church's heavy involvement in the passage of Proposition 8 in California. It was one thing to witness the church suppress freedom of artistic expression, but this was an attempt to suppress a freedom of expression that had far more profound effects on individual lives. I felt solidarity with the crowds that were protesting around the temples in L.A., Salt Lake, and in my own backyard in New York City. Oy vey, Jamir, what's a Jewish Mormon to do? How can I be a Mormon and be so at odds with its leadership and policies? But how can I be a Jew when I'm a Christian? As I felt the size of my genetic divide catastrophically colliding, my interest in genealogy became more than an engaging pastime. Rather, it became a project of intense urgency, a search for a reconciliation, a therapeutic attempt to understand my place within the complexity of genetic inheritance, and more specifically, my place within and relationship to Mormonism. I recognize, of course, there are many Mormons without my DNA who took great issue with the church's actions surrounding Prop 8 and other discriminatory practices, past and present. The support for gay rights, however, is far more pervasive in Jewish culture. After all, being gay was as damning in the eyes of the Nazis as being Jewish. At the time of Prop 8, the LA Times reported that 79% of Jews polled were accepting of homosexual lifestyle as compared to Mormons at 24%. I was really kind of surprised it was that high. Even my Orthodox Jewish cousin who lives in Israel, who immigrated to Israel, actually recently told me she has no problem with gay couples as long as they get married. The Jewish organization Birthright, which sends young people to on an all-expense-paid trip to Israel if you have one Jewish parent. this is my son. He went last year before he was going to age out at 26. He's the last one on the left picture. Here he is, all 6'3" of him on the shoulders of a very short rabbi who's dancing him around. And it was such a wonderful surprise for him to come home and tell me he'd been culturally bar mitzvahed at the Western Wall. So Birthright has these trips for straight and for gay youth in the hopes that in both cases there will be couples matched up and they will then form a family unit and commit to Israel. I acknowledge and am grateful for the many LDS church members who support gay and women's rights. I am using the disparity within my DNA as a means to frame my own personal struggles. We tell ourselves stories in order to live, observed the author Joan Didion. We live entirely, especially if we are writers, she continued, by the imposition of a narrative line upon disparate images, by the ideas with which we have learned to freeze the shifting phantasmagoria, which is our actual experience. So the story I'm telling myself, which is taking form in a book I'm writing, is Tinkleman and Jones, Tales of the Grandfathers, A Jewish Mormon's Quest for Religious Reconciliation. And by way of explanation, my Mormon ancestors were Stuarts. My father's surname was Jones, obviously. His father was not from an LDS background. He was a New Yorker with wanderlust and an apparent lust for my grandmother. And while passing through Utah, joined the church to get her to marry him. And then after a few kids, he left her and the church. But Tinkleman and Jones just had a nicer ring to it than Tinkleman and Stuart. So I've chosen as the beginning of the tale of my life that began before I was born two starting points, one in a town in rural northwestern New York along the St. Lawrence River near Canada, and the other in a village in what was the Russian Empire and is now eastern Ukraine. In 1841, 11 years after the formal organization of the Mormon Church, a missionary by the name of Alonzo Chee was proselyting in Ogdensburg, New York. And among his converts were my great-great-grandfather Charles Stuart, a farmer, and his wife Sarah Ann Roberts. Most of Charles and Sarah's ancestors have been in the Northeast since the 1600s and 1700s, several having arrived on the Mayflower. A decade prior to the Stuarts' conversion, Mormon prophet Joseph Smith had moved the body of the saints to Ohio, escaping persecution, and then Jackson County, Missouri. By 1833, anti-Mormon sentiment escalated, threatened by the Mormons' strange religion and their politically powerful, potentially powerful economic and political cohesion. Angry mobs formed and drove many Mormons from their settlement, setting fire to their houses, barns, and crops. After the Mormons clashed with Missouri State Guards at the Battle of Crooked River, the governor put out an extermination order which climaxed in the brutal murders at Hans Mill of 17 Mormon men, women, and children. With Joseph Smith temporarily imprisoned, Brigham Young and other church apostles, once again in search of refuge, led the Mormons to Illinois in the winter of 1838-39, and there they purchased the town of Commerce and renamed it Nauvoo, an anglicized spelling of the Hebrew word for beautiful. In September of 1843, 29-year-old Charles Stuart and his 23-year-old wife, Sarah, decided to take their 7-year-old daughter, Mary, and 10-month-old son, William, my great-grandfather, to join the Saints. Knowing they would never see their family again, they departed New York with sadness and reluctance. The Stuarts lived in Nauvoo for 2.5 years in relative peace, Charles devoting his spare time to working on building the temple. With the assassination of Joseph Smith in 1844 and increasing pressure on the Mormons from hostile neighbors, it soon became obvious that they would need to move again. And by the end of 1845, Mormon leaders negotiated a truce with Illinois officials, so the Latter-day Saints, numbering about 11,000 at this time, could prepare to abandon the city the following spring. The Stuarts sold their brick home for a yoke of oxen and a pair of running gears. There were many who wished to sell and few to buy, wrote my great-grandfather years later, and my mother's large feather bed had to be sacrificed to close the bargain. They bought a wagon box for $3 and used new bed sheets for cover. Hearing rumors of a coming raid, the Mormons were forced to depart earlier than planned, and in the bitter cold of late winter, the massive exodus from Nauvoo was set in motion. The Stuarts traveled to nearby Montrose, Iowa, where they stayed with non-Mormon relatives of Sarah. And on the 9th of February, the night following the great expulsion from Nauvoo, 9 babies were born among the refugees. Sarah walked the mile or so back from Montrose to the frozen banks of Sugar Creek, where the Mormons, ill-prepared to depart, she and her relatives brought them food baskets and clothing. The Mormons would refer to their month-long encampment along this Iowa stream as the Camp of Israel. And that's just interesting, of course, these constant appropriations of Jewish history among the Mormons. I'm not sure how the Jews feel about that, but I haven't asked. The Stuarts made their way west in fits and starts as funds would allow. From Montrose, they moved across Iowa, first to Keokuk, then in 1848 to Mosquito Creek, and the following year to Council Bluffs. Finally, Charles saved enough money to purchase new ox yokes and three cows to make the final leg of their journey to Utah Territory. In mid-June of 1852, the Stuarts departed with the James C. Snow Company of 250 people and 55 wagons. Early in the trip, upon reaching the Platte River, 15-year-old Mary Stuart jumped out of the wagon, and her skirt got caught in the draw bolt of the tongue and jerked her under the wheel, breaking her leg. She hollered, of course, recalled her 9-year-old brother William, who was driving the wagon that day, and it scared the cattle, and the whole train came very near going into the river. William was driving the wagon most days of the trip, as his father, Charles, was sick with cholera and his mother pregnant. Disease was rampant, and there were threats of altercations with Indians, as in one he writes about later, a band of 400 warriors came to their wagon train. Their arrival 3 months later into Utah Territory was also not without incident. While coming down the steep ravine of Echo Canyon at the Utah-Wyoming border, the King Bolt broke on the Stuart's wagon, and the tongue became wedged in the ground. Sarah was weak and recovering from childbirth. The oxen held the weight of the wagon back, bracing themselves almost in a squatting position. If the tongue had broken, it would likely have resulted in everyone's death in the wagon. But they were able to bolster it with large rocks and repair it, and finally got down into the valley, where they camped for a week along the Jordan River. After a week, they drove their wagon, herded their cattle toward downtown, and young William would later recall, "I shall never forget how glad I was when we first saw the city. I wouldn't ride, but wanted to run ahead to see it first." One can chart the Stuarts' journey by the births and deaths of their children, a daughter and son born in New York, a daughter born in Nauvoo who died at the age of two there, another daughter born in Keokuk, a daughter born and who also died at the age of two in Council Bluffs, and now the Stuarts' infant son, born during the descent down Echo Canyon, lived only 4 days. They named him Charles Echo Stuart. A week after their arrival in Utah, the Stuarts were sent south by Brigham Young to settle in Pleasant Grove, and as Charles and Sarah began their life in this small farming community far across the Atlantic Ocean in western Russia, my third great-grandfather, Ezekiel HaKohen, was living in Granov, a shtetl, which is Yiddish for small town, 271 kilometers south and slightly west of Kiev in the region of Podolia. He was the son of a rabbi, Joseph, and Jews didn't have last names till 200 to 300 years ago. And he was known as Tzedek Emetzer, which translates as a truly righteous person. They were members of the Kohanim, the priestly tribe believed to be direct descendants of Aaron. Shtetl communities like Granov, and this is photographs I downloaded from present day. It's now called, I don't know how to pronounce it, it's Hraniv, Hanriv, instead of Granov, were typically pious and followed the Jewish religion tradition of Tzedaka, charity, an ethos of compassion and activism for those in need. The whole community was responsible for the well-being of the poor, the orphan, the widow, and the elderly, not unlike the communal spirit of the Mormons' Nauvoo. Since the end of the 15th century, Jews had been excluded from settling within Russia, but after the annexation of large areas of eastern Poland in 1772 under Catherine the Great, Russia had to get used to a massive Jewish element within its borders. Granov was situated, as were most shtetls, in the Pale of Settlement, an area designated in 1791 as the only area within Tsarist Russia where Jews were authorized to reside, and Russian peasants were granted the right to demand expulsion of any Jews that lived among them in unauthorized areas. Jewish life in the Pale was hard and poverty-stricken. The Jews were deemed both infidels and economic rivals and were subjected to brutal persecution. The concentration of Jews in the Pale made them easy targets for anti-Jewish riots called pogroms, a Russian word for destruction or organized devastation. Though pogroms were staged throughout the existence of the Pale, particularly devastating attacks occurred during the aftermath of the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in 1881. Rumors arose that Jews were behind the assassination, and a rash of anti-Jewish riots broke out, starting in Podolia, where my ancestors lived, and spreading across the Pale of Settlement. The pogrom perpetrators organized locally, sometimes government and police encouragement, targeting hundreds of communities. Think Fiddler on the Roof. Thousands of Jewish homes and synagogues were destroyed, and countless Jews were lynched, murdered by neighbors, severely injured, and impoverished. And to escape the horror, 2 million Jews Jews would leave Russia between 1881 and 1914, mainly for the United States. As family legend tells it, Hezekiel HaKohen admonished his son Nusen Noder, which would be Nathan in English, my great-great-grandfather, to change his last name in order to escape forced conscription in the Tsar's army. Jews were often singled out for pejorative treatment in the military, and it was not uncommon to take such methods to be untraceable. And if you ask any Tinkleman, they'll tell you that their surname came off a tombstone. Now, of course, this is not in Russia, because it would have been in Hebrew. But this is me visiting. There's tons of Tinklemans buried in Poughkeepsie, New York, not too far from where I live. In 1901, my great-grandfather, Joseph Tinkleman, a bookkeeper in a granary, son of Nusen Noder, left his community of about 750 Jews, and with his oldest son joined that mass exodus for America. It's somewhat ironic that Joseph, had to declare in his immigration papers, I think it was the ship manifest, that he was not a polygamist in order to gain entrance to this country, when Fanny Eliza Hunt, the polygamous wife of my Mormon great-great-grandfather Charles Stewart, was quietly living out her life in Vernal, Utah. Like so many immigrant families, the Tinklemans came a few at a time as money would allow. Joseph's nephew, Charles, arrived destitute in America in 1911, leaving behind his wife and children, who would not make it to America until 1920, so that's 9 years. They would live through the bloodiest wave of pogroms, which broke out after 1903. Charles's sons, Aaron and Israel, who became Irving in this country, both recalled an experience following one murderous pogrom in which they had to help pile bodies of the townspeople, neighbors, families, friends, onto carts to take them to the cemetery, because there were so many bodies the dogs were starting to eat them. And despite being Kohanim and technically forbidden to enter a cemetery, these two boys, would have been about 10 and 12 at the time, had to disregard tradition and accomplish this very gruesome, sad task. In 1978, my mother and I conducted an oral history with Irving, who was then 73 years old. He shared with us the following. The first time the perpetrators, came in, they issued a proclamation that all Jews were to leave their homes and come to a very large open square in front of the church that was at the end of town. Those who would remain behind were to be burned in their homes, so everyone came, old, young, sick. So we gathered in this place, surrounded by men with machine guns and men on horses. From nowhere, it seemed, they brought up a wagon on which a group of men stood. In front of the wagon, was a huge tree, and they proceeded to hang the men from the wagon one after another. Mother, Aaron, Esther, and I were practically underneath the tree where they were hanging the men. We stayed there for some time watching the men's trigger finger on the machine guns mounted on the backs of wagons, and the only thing I can recall is Mother saying, when you see that man's hands on the machine guns reach for the trigger, you fall down and I will fall on top of you. Just remember me to your father. There was a rush. We fell down. Mama covered us, but the machine gun didn't go off. It seems a lookout man posted outside of town said the Red Army was advancing and they had to get out quickly. So they took 35 hostages with them, including Motel, my cousin, who had taught me to read and write. He and the 34 others were taken out and buried alive. In a memoir written many years later, Irving's brother Aaron wrote of the year-long journey that he and his brother Irving, at ages 15 and 13, took with their mother and younger sister after leaving Russia to get to America. Reminiscent of the Mormons' exodus from Nauvoo in the brutal winter months, he wrote, "It was winter and bitterly cold. We went by wagon towards a small town that separated Russia at that time from Bessarabia, which was then part of Romania. As we traveled, we were so cold that the man who drove the wagon would periodically drop Irving and me off the wagon and have us run behind to keep our circulation going. Sometimes they traveled by foot, one time having to walk across a river full of choppy ice. After working odd jobs in Romania, they were able to save enough money to take a train through Belgium to England, where they set sail for America. Fits and starts, making their way west across Europe, much like the Stuarts heading west for Utah. Aaron wrote of the slow sailing. The boat, he wrote, proceeded in the manner of what I would like to describe as a Leninist advance, two steps forward, one step back. It took weeks for us to get to New York City. And evoking William Stuart's joy at seeing Salt Lake City for the first time, Aaron Tinkleman, at 90-plus years of age, recalled making their way from Ellis Island to Grand Central Station, where they took a train to join a branch of the Tinklemans who had moved north to Poughkeepsie. I looked out the window, he recalled, and I felt that we had come to the greatest land in the world. In 1902... half a century after the trek to Utah, 60-year-old William Stuart decided to write his autobiography.
Sip of water.
As he picked up his pen to record his reminiscences of coming across the plains as a young boy, back along the eastern seaboard that same year, my 15-year-old maternal grandfather, David Isidore Tinkleman, set sail with two of his brothers from Bremen, Germany, for the port of entry in Philadelphia. They then made their way north to New York, where their father, Joseph, had settled the previous year. Like many Mormon ancestors who gathered with fellow religionists in Nauvoo and then Utah, the Tinklemans settled in Brownsville, Brooklyn, and this is a picture of myself and my daughter. We went and found the home where my mother lived in as a little girl. And as we were driving around, I said to both my children in the car, this place has really been taken over by, and they were sure I was going to say minorities, and I said Christians, because there were these big Jesus murals everywhere. But anyway. It was a very wonderful trip to make, to find the places where even my great-grandparents had lived, which, you know, you can get those addresses when you do census research. Joseph Tinkleman's brothers would also immigrate, and together with their sons, they entered what was called the rag trade, operating a dressmaking factory in Brooklyn and eventually up in Poughkeepsie. After surviving vicious anti-Semitism in Russia, my great-grandfather Joseph would die at the age of 48 from an infection caused by a puncture in his finger from a contaminated sewing needle. In his epic poem Ulysses, Tennyson's protagonist, the great traveler, declares, "I am a part of all that I have met." Doing genealogy is akin to time traveling, and like Ulysses, I feel part of all whom I have met on my family tree. My DNA test confirmed I am half Jewish, but of course there was nothing that said you're half Mormon. And as my eyes wander over the names on my multi-generation chart, I walk through the stories of my ancestors with my mind's eye. I explore the lush forests around the upper Canajoharie, village of the Mohawk Nation near Schenectady, New York, where my sixth great-grandmother, a Mohawk Indian, lives with her husband, a Dutch trapper, who arrived in the New World in 1634. I wander the wilds of eastern Canada with my seventh great-grandfather, a French trapper and interpreter, among the Algonquin Indians for Champlain. I mourn for the husband and children of my other Mormon great-great-grandmother, who succumbs to cholera at the age of 36 in St. Louis, having survived an arduous journey by sea to New Orleans from her native England, never making it to Utah. I bump along the trail with William Henry Stuart, my 9-year-old grandfather, to the Valley of the Mormons, pondering what did it mean to him and his family, descendants of Mayflower pilgrims, to leave the United States behind. I trail alongside those who went to war, my Gentile ancestors who fight in the American Revolution, the War of 1812, the Civil War, my Jewish relatives who, after immigrating to America, go back to Europe to fight in World War I. I crawl with my Utah-born father, a medic, as he assists the wounded on Utah Beach. in Normandy. I grieve for Israel Tinkelman, brother of my great-great-grandfather, who dies in 1942 in a Nazi camp in Moldova, in Balti, Moldova, and all the other Jews who perish without a proper Kaddish, a prayer of mourning. I hold the hand of my Jewish grandmother, who, at Miriam Reese, my mother's mother, as she arrives alone at the age of 14 at Ellis Island, she's a little older here, from the Austrian province of Galicia. Her parents and younger siblings would not follow for 7 years. I stand with her 2 years later as she marries my Russian grandfather in a Brooklyn courthouse, their courtship having been carried out in their common language of Yiddish. And I stand with my parents in Poughkeepsie, New York, as my mother, wearing dark clothing, mourning the death of her mother, and already a widow herself, marries a handsome World War II veteran who was born into a religion of which she knows nothing. This is the great project of genealogy. Every individual deserves to be met on the ground on which they stand. Every life matters. Every life counts for something. No matter how flawed, no matter how mundane, no matter how grandiose. No people are uninteresting, wrote the Russian poet Yevtushenko. Not people die, but worlds die in them. I'm no respecter of persons on my family tree. I don't feel privileged for having descended from blessed, honored pioneers, nor do I feel special for being the granddaughter of a member of the Kohanim. But what I do take upon myself and wear as a badge of honor is the humanity, the foils and triumphs, struggles and joys of every person whose bloodline I share. I celebrate their profound differences and their similar quests. Woven through the tales of my Mormon and Jewish grandfathers are themes of exile, expulsion, extermination, exodus. They endured tremendous hardship to obtain religious and political freedom and the right of self-determination. This knowledge informs and deepens my commitment that I cannot abide any organization, particularly one with which I am associated, that treats its members like errant children if they question or step outside prescribed boundaries, or whose ideology or theology, policies, or attitudes diminish in any way the dignity and humanity of the individual. My struggle to live with internal strife continues as my ire with the Mormon Church rises again with the recent excommunication of a feminist human rights advocate and the threat of more disciplinary courts to come. But in my heart and mind, I return again and again to my one grounding place, the bifurcated home of my youth. Despite their vastly different backgrounds and temperaments, my parents taught me by example to respect everyone, regardless of race, religion, socioeconomic background, or sexual orientation, to honor the attendant implications of such a worldview, that there is no them and us, and it is to them, Ruth Tinkelman and Charles Stewart Jones, that this talk and the book I am writing is dedicated. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Linda. That was very, very interesting. I also find myself in the rather strange position of being a Jewish Mormon art historian. And I grew up in Maine. Both my parents were converts to the church, but my father's family are Eastern European Jews from Ukraine and Austria and Germany, and my mother's family are from the United Kingdom. But I grew up, and I went to Hebrew school as a kid, so, like, I'm legit. In your narrative of your family history, you're talking about, like, the challenges of the one side as they move west and the challenges of your Jewish family as they leave persecution behind, and very, very gruesome stories of persecution and discrimination, and effectively have to travel 12,000 miles, you know, kind of to the United States. One thing comes up in my mind. I'm a professor of art history at Dixie State University, and we have various culture wars among the faculty at various times. And we have a divide in the faculty. We have those who are Mormon and those who are not Mormon. And this kind of idea of the narrative or of competing narratives of persecution comes up in these faculty debates. quite frequently. And I don't have Mormon pioneer ancestry, but my husband is entirely Mormon pioneer and so on both sides of his family. And so my children are going to grow up with these competing narratives of persecution. And the way that I see this play out very often in my own life is that some obnoxious faculty member will try and start a fight, which is not hard to do if you want to start a cultural battle in a place where culture is a very hot button issue, and insist that Mormon pioneers suffered more than any other group has ever suffered ever. And I don't, does this sound familiar to anyone? Okay. And then immediately other faculty members, generally non-Mormons, will jump in and also say, well, that's, yes, your group was persecuted, but you know, not really in living memory and not in the way that other groups have been persecuted. And so to be the child of both the kind of the Mormon narrative and the pioneer narrative and of the Jewish narrative, which is one that I'm very familiar with, of, you know, very similar story, you know, family coming from Ukraine in 1881 to Baltimore and, you know, trying to make it as an immigrant family and all the things that the reasons they were pushed out of their families and left behind. You know, my last name is Ross, but my maiden name is Moss, which is a shortened form of Moskowitz, and both my grandparents, who are now deceased, could, you know, I grew up hearing stories of the anti-Semitism that they experienced and that kind of thing. And so in my own life, I feel like though I do not descend from Mormon pioneers, that this narrative of persecution is very strong within our church, and also having this other narrative that I inherit of Jewish persecution and anti-Semitism. And I guess the point that I want to make is, do you feel you, and again, this is maybe just the first question of the questions, do you feel, you said that in your family you didn't feel like, you know, that wasn't necessarily a conflicting narrative within your family, but do you feel culturally that those narratives are in conflict? And I don't know if you want.
Yes.
can you explain that, or do you have an example of that?
I'm not sure I totally understand the question.
I guess the question is, do you frequently experience the, I've had it worse, your people have not had it so bad, but then because you embody both of these traditions in your genealogy, am I making any sense?
I haven't been confronted too often with someone saying, we had it worse than you.
Oh, okay.
I think the only time I leapt out of my seat and chased someone down in church was when someone said how the Mormons in California were persecuted after Prop 8. And yeah, I tackled them in the hall.
Way to go.
I don't know if that answers.
No, that totally answers my question. And I guess the second question or topic that I'm quite interested in is the story you presented initially where with the censorship. And that's great, because as an art historian, I've heard rumors, and I don't know how true or not they are, about censorship in art and art history at BYU. And
tell the Roxanne story.
I think
there's a lot to tell. People know about that, right?
Not really.
Oh. Okay.
So I would love to hear more about.
To be remembered.
I would like to hear a little more as well about the tension between a cultural institution like BYU art museums, the general liberalism of art history,
the discipline,
and the problem of religion and in that particular context. Like if there are more stories like that, I think that would be quite an interesting way in which cultures conflict.
Did you want me to?
I would love to hear the story. Sorry, and that's the last of my comments.
Okay. My first job was working for the church museum, so I was working with Mormon art, so it wasn't an issue there, except that, I will say, the general authorities that were over the museum did not like the idea of one-person shows, because it called attention to an individual, and that was antithetical to the beehive symbol and notion of the church, where no one person should stand out, you know, too much. And so that was a problem, because we did do a couple of one-person, one-artist shows, but they were frowned upon. As I was telling someone, I thought it was ironic that Boyd Packer had a show at the Museum of this bird sculptures, just him. there are always exceptions to the rule. I was not being nice, I was telling the truth. So at BYU, well, as an art student at BYU, you know, we couldn't have nude models, and that, you know, so people had to go off campus to do that. The Rodin, you all know about, right? They were trying, Rodin show had been contracted to come, and I don't know if it was before the pieces got to the campus, they realized that, was it two of them? This was a long time ago, and I was gone.
They were at the campus, and Winifred Campbell was appointed director.
Yeah, so there... A couple were deemed inappropriate to be shown. I think one of them was the kiss.
Yeah,
which is about as benign and, and the other one was...
It was the prophet Ezekiel or Isaiah who was naked.
Some naked prophet. And so they were not allowed to show those, and it was, all I kept thinking was, thank God I'm not there, because...
What year was this?
97, because I would have probably been fired after we had changed our whole life around living there in Utah. Because the director had to tout the party line on this, and even though I'm sure he didn't agree, and
he was totally baffled.
Yeah,
because he taught Native art in Australia. They didn't do clothes on art pieces in Australia.
Right. So, but he had to, go along, and I wouldn't have been able to. So I was really glad that I wasn't there for that. It's just ironic because kids go on semester abroad and go stand at the feet of David, but if it's in your own backyard, it's a whole nother story, I guess. I don't know. Did that address? Any other? Are we out of time?
Yeah, I'm happy to moderate any questions that people have if you want. Go ahead and come up and speak in the microphone so the recorder will hear your question. Anybody like to come up?
Yes.
Linda, do you have siblings? And if so, do they have these same personality characteristics that you mentioned?
I do have siblings. My brother's an atheist and my sister is a Wiccan. So, but we all get along dearly. But there is this strain of kind of anti-authoritarianism. But my brother's like a totally, he's not totally left brain, but because he is a musician, doctor. But my sister's way out in
California.
Yeah.
Hey.
No, it is interesting that none of my Mormon family have stayed Mormon as far as close relatives. Like, I don't have any first cousins that are stayed in the church or aunts and uncles or anything like that. But actually, most of my Jewish cousins are very secular, and except for one. Some became Christian. It's all mixed up.
I'm very interested in the concept of genetic memory, and I've had that feeling for quite some time. So if you would remind me of exactly what that is called. And also, in your genealogical research, do you feel a particular closeness to any one of those progenitors?
It's called, and it's a mouthful, but it's transgenerational epigenetics, so epi means on top of, inheritance. And if you Google it, you'll find articles about it. And they've done studies, of course, with mice and, whatnot. What was the other question?
Do you feel
any kinship? Uh-huh. I didn't like my Mormon grandmother at all. I found her and she had a hard life, but I definitely, and I didn't know my Jewish grandparents, but I like to think I would have been very close to my Jewish grandmother from all that I read about her and all my mother told me about her. I think I looked a little bit like her. So I would have to say, yeah, definitely I feel more culturally attuned to the Jewish side. And I also wasn't raised with all the things that Mormon, you know, can make jokes about, the Jell-O salads and all that stuff was not part of my growing up. So culturally, I don't feel Mormon.
Not that it's about Jell-O.
If I heard you correctly, you were saying something about going on a therapeutic journey. And I was wondering if you could speak to how this research and this project that you're working on is helping you, you know, with your spiritual health, with your mental health, anything like that.
Well, I don't know if I can answer that simply. Although all I know is I would probably be in therapy if I weren't doing this. But it takes me out of myself and out of my head and gets me pondering and thinking about all these other lives and accepting the good and the bad that has come down to me as being part of me, and trying not to be so hard on the Mormon side in my mind and trying not to demonize that side, which I tend to do. Because of personal things that have happened to me and members of my family because of the Mormon church. So, yeah, it's working through the angst. I don't know how better to say it than in my, yeah, just getting out of my head and getting into others. And I don't know. That was not very eloquent. Are you stopping me?
No.
Well, I was like, stop with your head, Linda. Anyway.
Thank you.
Linda, could you speak to the issue of how this translates to the next generation? I know that for myself growing up, genealogy was what Aunt Pearl bored us with at every family reunion, so we all ran screaming in the opposite direction. But it sounds to me as though you found a way to entwine your journey with the two halves, well, obviously it's more than just two halves of your ancestral journey. And how do you translate that or involve Chelsea and Graham in it so that it's not just mom doing her crazy thing again?
Thanks, Levina. I'm very fortunate that my children are, I would say, sincerely interested in what I'm doing and have come with me on my journeys. We went and found my mother's grandparents' graves in Queens, and they came with me, and we took pictures, and I've had, the tombstones translated because there's a lot in Hebrew, and they came along. They're just, I don't know, I'm fortunate that they, you know, I try to make it live for them, and they didn't know their Jewish grandparents or well, they knew their Jewish grandmother, my mother, but I don't know, I'm just lucky. And I guess my overall enthusiasm, I'll be in my office and I'll yell, "We've got a Mayflower pilgrim," you know, I had no idea. You know, and they come running in, and it's just, and then we made a trip to Plymouth. We'd never gone up there all the years we'd lived in New York, so we made a trip up there, went to the museums, learned all about it, so I try to make it live for them, I guess.
Have you done anything explicit so that it becomes part of their identity formation? I mean, kids, especially as teenagers, have to decide pieces of who they are, mm-hmm. and your children are a little bit older than that now, but is there some way that they connect explicitly to this is who I am or this is part of who I am?
My son is not really interested in organized religion per se, and when I asked him about Israel, when he went to Israel, you know, did you feel anything, you know? Because I love seeing, he looks good in a yarmulke, what can I say? But he said, well, he loved the trip, but he said when he saw the little children, the little boys at the Wailing Wall, you know, like this, and that automatron posture and without, you know, being, he would call it brainwashed probably, it was really upsetting to him, and he So he's not identified with either side particularly. He just is open. He loves and enjoys, you know, experiences that I put forth. But my daughter is definitely aligned with Mormonism, but she's very much kind of an activist and aware of rights for gays. Her brother's gay. My son is gay. And women's rights. You know, she's gonna do her thing to help people in the church. But she's gonna do it from within. He's gonna do it by just being a good person.
Still got plenty of time, folks. Any other questions?
I won't get too personal.
Okay,
I want to hear about your book. I just want to hear what your time frame is. What I mean, it's obviously a biography, I'm assuming, on your family, but just a little detail about what your time frame is and what your approach.
The tricky thing when you're into genealogy is stopping the research and starting the family story. And so as I'm working, I think, I'm just going to try one more thing, got to do one more thing. And so I actually requested your sent a proposal into Sunstone in the hopes that it would force me to write this armature for what I hope will be the book. So I don't have a time frame. I'm going to flesh it out. I've got to start doing a lot more research. I don't know if I want to go to the Ukraine right now, particularly. We'll see. I am going to Israel next year because I have found that there are Tinklemans, and if you're a Tinkleman, you're related. So I don't know. I'm just going to forge ahead. So.
But you do have trips planned, so you've got your journey already going.
Oh, I do, and I need to go to upstate New York, where so many of the non-Jewish family came from for way, 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 way back. So. And I've been preparing by reading books that are similar to what I want to do. I just read this wonderful book called The Family by David Laskin, who he weaves his family history with the bigger picture of history. So you cast the personal against the universal, and he's Jewish, secular Jew, but he had his great aunt immigrated and founded the Maiden Form Bra Company and became a tycoon. One branch became Zionist and went to Israel. One branch stayed in Russia and died in the Holocaust, which is a typical story for many Jewish families. But he cast these individual stories against this wider sweep of history, which makes it, I think, so interesting. I met someone who wasn't a Jew that read it and loved it. So I'm looking at models by reading other books.
Who is the author again?
David Laskin.
Laskin?
L-A-S-K-I-N. It's called The Family. And I think it would be interested for anyone writing a family history. What else? I'm trying to think of another book. Anyway, is it that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you everybody for your time and for your questions. And thanks again to Nancy and Linda for sharing your story. And that pretty much wraps everything up. Thank you everybody for your participation.
Thank you.